we have all these sort of informal taglines, one of which is make money, have fun. That works. That like culture of fun works because at the core, we've got a bunch of autonomous 11s who are really serious about doing great work. So the culture of fun only works if you know you have these driven humans who want to do spectacular work on behalf of clients.
What do the world's best CROs have in their playbooks? This is the place to find out. This is Reveal, the Revenue Intelligence Podcast. I'm your host, Dana Feldman. Hi, y'all. I'm Dana Feldman, and this is Reveal, the Revenue Intelligence Podcast. Each episode, we are focused on helping you build the ultimate CRO playbook. And we promise to give you access to the most influential revenue leaders at the world's top companies so that you too can achieve your goals. As the SVP of Global Revenue for Yahoo DSP, Alia oversees the business globally, driving strategic growth and innovative solutions for advertisers. With over 15 years of experience leading high-performing teams and industry-defining strategies, she has been instrumental in shaping the future of digital media and advertising. Alia's experience spans programmatic advertising, data-driven insights, and delivering results for some of the biggest brands in the world. Beyond, obviously, her impressive professional journey, Alia is passionate about empowering her teams and creating a collaborative culture that thrives on innovation. So with that, I am really excited to dive in. Alia, welcome to the show.
Awesome. Thank you, Dana. I'm really happy to be here. Nice to see you.
So let's start really just kind of from the beginning. Tell the leaders a little bit about your career journey and how you got to where you are today.
I lucked into the ad tech industry. It's been incredibly fun and rewarding. I feel very fortunate to have gotten into it. I started at a startup called advertising.com in 2002. When I graduated from college, it was a Baltimore headquartered ad tech startup, really before the moniker of ad tech even existed. Started by two brothers, John and Scott Ferber, who are amazingly influential and smart and fun. And no one in the building was over the age of 30. So we had a rich work life and personal life too, which there's a lot of good stories there. And I was there from 2002 all the way to 2010. So we actually got bought by AOL in 2004. And we ran as a wholly owned corporate subsidiary for most of that time. And then in 2010, I followed some other really smart, bright, talented people over to Millennial Media, which was another Baltimore-based ad tech startup, this time mobile advertising. So the iPhone came out in 2007, Millennia launched shortly thereafter. And in 2010, I went over there to run the Southeast region and then kind of just had the opportunity, as one does at a startup, to do more and more and the next thing and the next thing, mainly because there just wasn't anybody else to do the other things. So it was like, we need leadership in Chicago and Detroit, you know, hand raising for that, or we need leadership in Dallas, hand raising for that. And then ultimately that included the East Coast. We moved to New York with Millennial, my husband and I, and two of our three kids. And then Millennial was bought by AOL and Verizon in 2015. So it was a very interesting full circle moment of having, you know, been a subsidiary of AOL for all that time at advertising.com and then going back into due diligence with the AOL team again as a purchase, and then moving back over to AOL with a lot of people that I had worked with before who had come from advertising.com, who are some of my great friends and still are to this day. So that was a really cool moment to do a little bit of that boomerang opportunity. After that, Verizon had bought AOL in May of 15. They then bought Millennial in October of 15. They then bought Yahoo in like June of 17, and then in 21, divested and sold AOL and Yahoo, which we were calling Oath at the time, or we were back to Verizon Media at that point, to Apollo Capital. And so that was 21. We had a new CEO, Jim Lanzone, who's amazing. We've been operating as Yahoo ever since.
You were truly at the cutting edge beginning days of online advertising. What would surprise our listeners about that time and that era, do you think? That, I mean, this was not a well-paved space, motion, you know, here's what you do. So I don't know, just what would surprise listeners that you've kind of reflected on during that time?
You know, this was pre-RTB, right? So this was like IO-based digital buying that we were on the path of becoming programmatic ultimately, but the manual nature of the things that we did, from the conversion, like manual conversion matching in huge spreadsheets, you know, just powered by your average VLOOKUP, right? Sort of taking SKU numbers. I mean, it was so manual. Everything we did was so manual. And we were definitely a hide the crazy period of time because we were way out ahead of ourselves with the capability of the technology that we had. And yet a lot of it was still pretty manual. So we had an incredible performance algorithm, but like the reporting and the measurement and all the pieces that came from that, I would love to go back to 2002, 2003 advertising.com and just kind of run through those systems and see that again. It's come such a long way. And we were, to your point, like we were bleeding edge in performance marketing. And Millennial was similar. And there were a lot of things that we were doing manually, just fast and furious to try to keep up with client demand. So I think that's the thing that would be so fun to go back and see. If I could tell myself, you know, that we were going to have access to all of these tools. We have always had machine learning, but just what AI's done, even over the last couple of years, it's been wild.
It's so funny. I remember this era as well. And I was actually doing an internship like 2000, and I built this company's website, and we wanted to get it bumped up on the search engines, right? And so back then you could call Google, and I'm trying to like negotiate them into telling me what's like, I don't even know if algorithm was like a word back then, but like, I'm like, well, how do we get bumped up? You know, and they're like trying to dance around it. But it's just like, you were really just trying to build or scrape at whatever you could back then, because it was so not defined. So yes, I feel you.
And that would have been Overture and Google, right? Which since Overture ultimately got bought by Yahoo, and then that brand went away. But it's just that it was a totally different cast of characters in the industry. And yet some have stuck around and been, you know, resilient through it all. So it's very cool to see it. And those people that I worked at advertising.com with have gone on to lead huge companies and functions within massive, you know, Fortune 10 companies and product at Amazon. And it's just very cool to see all those, we were kids, and what they're doing now and the professional success that they've had is really fun to be a part of too.
So the other thing you just mentioned in your story and journey is several times you talked about, so I raised my hand for that opportunity. I raised my hand to move there. I raised my hand for this, right? This concept of like raising your hand. Talk to me a little bit about that. But I think along just in general with like that is, how do you make the decision about what you raised your hand for? You know, I think this is a really interesting concept for people that want to grow their career. In doing that, how did you also not let fear or other things get in the way from just kind of jumping at some opportunities, which I think often happens to a lot of individuals?
So a couple key things in terms of raising your hand and being in a position in my life where I could raise my hand. I had no one else to be responsible for. I had a really great boyfriend who later turned into a spectacular husband. He was in New York and I was in Baltimore. We had no kids. It was all about what can I do to grow? And there was this awesome environment of, again, I went back-to-back startups, 200 person startups, in some case less, and then they grew to that. But that really fostered this opportunity of like, we are all trying to do this. I mean, now there's this whole thing about founder mode. Like everyone in that building was in founder mode at that time. Like everyone really cared about the success of the whole team. And if something needed to be done, then everyone raised their hand. And if that wasn't what you were into, you probably didn't work there that long, right? Because there were a lot of different things that had to get done. And I don't think raising my hand for those things was particularly unique. That's just what we did. And that was the culture that we came up in. And having no personal responsibility, it was like, do you want to move to Atlanta? Yes, sure, great, wonderful. Do you want to take on this role, this team, travel these days and weeks? Like, yes, of course I do, because we're just trying to run the world, you know? It's like a really fun moment in time that is, you know, it's different now. Every decision you make now has a cascading influence on the huge team that reports to you, your family that depends on you, your social structure around you. It was different.
I think it's interesting, though, because I get into this topic a lot with our guests. And I think early in your career, this idea of like, how planned out do you need to have it? I think people sometimes get a little too stuck in like titles, or is this move directly moving me up a level? Where like, I love this concept of raising your hand. And I've said it before, but this idea of like, treating your career like it's a passport book. And you've got to go and get stamps in different areas to broaden your experience to then give you those like more senior or bigger scoped roles or other opportunities. So when you talked about raising your hand, I had to double click on it. I think it's really interesting. Do you have any sort of point of view that you typically share with your team, or you've kind of built over the years around how do you manage your career and how to approach it?
I do. It's evolved. It's still evolving. I love your concept of the passport. I think that's really interesting. In ad tech, particularly, the pace of change and compute power and how that impacts how quickly we move is so rapid that, I mean, you're getting like a passport a day sometimes, right? Like there are new data relationships and partner agreements and technical capabilities that we're trying to keep up with every single day. And I think what I've learned is that you really do have to be as immersed in it as you can be. So you have to want to do it. It has to be interesting. And for me, the most interesting part of it is always the business that my clients run. So I'm most interested in how can I help GM sell more Escalades, or Papa John's sell more pizza, Dunkin's more coffee, and on and so on. That's the most interesting thing to me. And then the ad tech part of it supports that curiosity and desire to support them. So ad tech's a tool. I am not a particularly technical person. I still need friends and colleagues and family members to help me with ridiculous things. I just put Perplexity on my iPhone. So I'm trying to stay as current as I can, but that's not my natural habitat. I have to push to that. So if I can take the tech piece of my job and position it back toward, you know, the business portion and the client facing portion and the curiosity that I have about what makes my client's business run, that seems to work really well for me. And so I would say, as you're building a career, you need to find the particular thing in your path that lights you up the most. And you might be in commercial real estate, and maybe, you know, maybe that doesn't totally light you up, but the human aspect or the customer-based aspect, if that's the thing that you care most about, then you lead into that. You know, as a kid, I didn't say I want to be in ad tech when I grow up. I wanted to be a journalist on TV like Katie Couric. I wanted to be asking questions and conducting interviews and doing that. And I think I do that every single day, multiple times a day. And I'm asking questions about ad tech and business. You know, there's still like the human interest part of that. So I think it's just like looking at your career and connecting with the part of it that you love and then holding on to that and driving toward that, because whatever you love the most is usually what you are best at. And we do best when we're doing what we do best. I think that's important.
What about a lesson that you've learned, or maybe even if you want to call it a mistake in your career, a reflection moment for you, something that really taught you something that you brought into the rest of your career? Would love to just hear maybe what that is.
So many lessons and a lot of mistakes. And I try really hard not to think too much about the mistakes for much longer. Over a glass of wine, I can tell you some of my worst. But I would say from an early career advice perspective that was given to me by a leader at advertising.com was, you are going to need favors from all of these people. So you get out there on the second floor and you make them all your friends. So that was the trafficking people, the legal people, computer science people, the tech folks, like everyone in this building is related back to making sales successful in some way. And you're going to need to call on them at any moment in time, and they better know your name. And it would even be better if you had recently done them a favor, you know? So like this kind of concept of favor trading, I think is something that I've taken forward in my career. And it brings me great joy to do favors for people or to help somebody. It could be, you know, a job connection, or it could be any number of things. But I love to be actively doing favors for people. And I know that that's also going to work out for me in the future too. So there is a currency around, I am very comfortable with you calling me, asking me for a favor, because that just means that when I call you, you'll be comfortable to do that back for me too. So that concept of like everyone in this building is important to what you do in some capacity and you need to figure out what it is. I was taught that pretty early on at advertising.com.
So powerful, especially for all of us in sales, the currency between all the teams that support us. How do you show up for them? How do you make them feel part of this team and know that like we are not doing this alone? So I feel you very much on that answer. I'm curious. I know that I've heard you mention a concept called Autonomous 11. Will you tell us a little bit more about that and how it impacts the way that you drive results with your team?
It's important to take note that I don't feel like I drive results. I feel like I hopefully encourage results or engender drive or mostly hire people who are what I call autonomous 11s, which is essentially like you have an internal drive and a personal integrity. You don't need me to drive you. And those are the best salespeople. They wake up in the morning thinking about what value can they drive for their customers that in exchange would bring more budget from a competitor to us. That's what drives the best salespeople. And so they don't need any additional drive from me, right? They are motivated by that. And then 11 for me is just this version of, I love to find the people that are 11 out of 10 in that particular category, right? So 10s are great. Show me the people who overachieve. We joke around at work a little bit about bring me your anxiety and I will turn it into sales success. But like if you wake up at 3 a.m. thinking about what you didn't do or the email you didn't send or a better way to do that and you write a note down, I mean, that would be the behavior of an autonomous 11.
When you are interviewing for this characteristic, do you have a question, two great questions that you ask to really eke this out?
So here's the tricky part of this. It is very difficult in an interview environment to determine true autonomous 11s. You can get some really great indicators. You know, you can get part of the way there. You can assume based on the answers that they give that they're like that. But there are, to me, the best way to screen for that is to go find people who worked with those folks who were actually in the trenches working on a project up against a deadline. And this goes back to favor currency. I'm always kind of just recycling old contacts to say, did you work with this person? How closely did you work with this person? What kind of work did you do with this person? Because even, you know, in your day to day, you can work fairly closely with a person, but not be in the trenches with them on a project. And it's hard to understand, you know, how they really operate. So I think the best interview version of that is the external.
The back channeling, right? That you get. Yeah, we all are. You have to be, right? I mean, that's the heart of the matter, right? Is that you can go back and back channel. So it's powerful. And I also think that's something that newer to career folks often overlook is your career journey is long, but the world that you tend to live in is very small. And so, you know, you've got to keep that in mind in whatever decisions or however you want to show up throughout that journey. I'm going to steal your autonomous 11.
Yeah, by all means. We've got someone in the interview process right now that a guy on my team came back and said, wow, Alia, she's actually an autonomous 12, I think. So we can ratchet it up from there, Dana.
I love it. Okay, so I think this is obviously one of the things that you use to make sure that you're getting the right team in place. After they've been hired, is there an effective tool or practice that you continuously use to drive results with your team or to, you know, because you said like, I don't look at myself as driving the team to results, but a way that you help them on the path to get there.
I don't know if I would call it a tool, but we do a lot of work on communication style internally, which I think from a sales perspective, you have to be able to communicate carefully. But we work with a group called Gallagher Edge and do a ton of organizational psychology work. So around direct communication, making sure to not triangulate internally and instead go back to the human being directly with a clear framing of how a particular conversation made you feel, how you can work through things together, kind of getting a hold of like your internal emotion around something, approaching everything. I have a great leader who always talked about assume positive intent. So we actually do a lot of that woo work. And there are people on my team who roll their eyes at that. And then they do it anyway. And they're grateful that they've done it. So I believe in that in terms of driving revenue results. And I think there's a direct correlation between how well the team can work together and collaborate together, both intra and inter team in an organization too.
Do you have a personal example of where you've used that training and it's changed, you know, something in how things are going internally? I'd love for you to share it if you're comfortable with the listeners.
I'm happy to. One that just, I mean, there's a zillion, honestly, Dana, but one that comes to the top of my head would be prep work for a conversation that maybe isn't going to be a pleasant conversation by being so direct that at the beginning of the conversation, you say, this is going to be a hard conversation for me. Or this is going to be a really direct piece of feedback, right? So you kind of let people take a minute and gather themselves and prepare to receive something that they might not be thrilled to hear. Honestly, our HR team at Yahoo is really great in coaching toward that too. This is going to be a difficult conversation, right? And then you can go right into whatever feedback you need to go into to help that person, you know, give you more of what you need and they need to be successful in this organization.
I think one of my favorites along those lines is certainly when there's feedback to be given and it is feedback that will be needle moving to that person's success at the organization. And one of my mentors taught me this was like to open it up and saying, you know, I want to give you some feedback. I want to frame this up that this is needle moving in terms of your success at this company. And I really appreciate you taking the time to hear me out, right? And then you give it to kind of give them that framing of like, is this just like a little niggly thing? Or is this going to basically dictate whether or not you're going to have a long time at this organization or a long path?
And who would not be willing to hear needle moving feedback, right? I want that all the time. One of the things I think that happens is when you get to be more senior in your career is there are fewer people kicking around who will give you needle moving feedback.
You also, as senior leaders, we have to hire and surround ourselves with some people that are willing to give us that feedback and are willing to be bold or just be comfortable. I guess bold would be too strong of a word.
And everyone can be comfortable if you create an environment that they feel like they can do that, right? Like, so that's a really important tenet of leadership too. Like, let me make you feel comfortable enough to tell me when I'm doing something that's not working for you or that's hampering your success or that you need more of. I hope that I can create that. I work hard at that. It's challenging.
My leaders and I recently, we had this leadership offsite and we recognized that we weren't creating enough moments for feedback both ways. And so for each of my leaders, we have a one-on-one doc and we each go in and put in our topics. We track action items. Like that's kind of our agenda, right? And now we have a set section in there that's feedback. And so every week that section is set in there and allows us to have that moment of like, hey, do you have any feedback? Do you have any feedback for me this week? Nope. Great. They asked me the same. And we don't every week, but at least it creates a safe space for me to show as a leader I want it. And then they don't have to think about how and when am I going to give Dana that feedback if I have some, you know?
Yeah, because no one on your team wants to say, hey, Dana, this is going to be a difficult conversation.
Totally. And they don't want to schedule time, you know, being like, okay, so this is feedback. So this is what I'm trying. There's no silver bullet, but to your point, like trying to create the culture. Talk to me about just how do you seek out innovation from your teams? You know, you talked about the early days of the industry that you're in and just scrappy, figuring it out, trying new ideas, you know, but in today's world, how do you eke some of that innovation out from your team?
We absolutely have a currency of innovation at the Yahoo DSP. So the good news is that it's all around us. And the things I mentioned earlier, just about the speed of compute power and innovation and machine learning and AI, it's happening so quickly. And the best way that my team and myself can have connectivity to that is tight, tight collaboration with our product teams. We do a lot of work. Product and sales at the Yahoo DSP are probably tighter than at any place I've ever worked, just in terms of how closely and we work together and how direct we are with feedback, how hard we work to make sure that we are on the same page and consistently collaborating. Innovation is what we sell and market. So it's critically important. Everything we do is done under the lens of innovation. We gather a ton of feedback from our clients. We make sure that we share that with product. We have an opportunity for product to get that feedback directly from clients. There's a lot of, sometimes we joke because, you know, product and engineering need to do product and engineering work. Like they don't need to go on sales calls with me, but it's so valuable when they do. So trying to kind of, you know, just consolidate that information back. Our client councils are done in lockstep with our product team as well. So we have twice a year client advisory board, council meetings, and it's product plus sales. So they get to hear that too. We break into small groups for very direct feedback from our clients. And we take a lot of that into consideration for the product roadmap too. So it matters a lot for us to be able to stay aligned.
I think any sales leader would feel this. I'm curious, and thank you. You got into some of the examples around the customer advisory board. I mean, tactically, what do you do to really keep that closeness to product? Do you guys have a weekly meeting between product and all sales leaders? Do you guys have a different forum? Like, share some of that, because I think this is an ever-going challenge for any of us in sales with our counterparts in product.
We do have a weekly meeting on Tuesday nights at 5 o'clock Eastern, and that is sales leadership and product leadership together with a few partners from pricing and yield management and legal. There's a few other partners that kind of come in and come out of that meeting as well. It goes through everything from specific agenda items that we need to talk about and that we kind of need to hash out in terms of product roadmap, et cetera, all the way to industry news and what's going on and what's your take on, you know, this new article that launched about our partner or our competitor. So that's a really great meeting every week for us to be able to do that. The head of product and I are really close. We talk several times a day. We're on a lot of meetings together. The strategy, product strategy team that reports up to him works incredibly closely with me and with my team to make sure that all of the input back from our sales teams makes it back to the actual product managers and the engineering team. They're controlling all of that flow and the prioritization process. Sales is present in the prioritization process as well. So we are totally intermingled, and it's a pretty tight knit, which is great. And we really like each other. I think that's what's going on right now that makes Yahoo feel so fun. Like, everybody is happy to be here and everybody loves the rest of the team. And if you ask anybody at Yahoo, I think one of the things they'll say first is the people. I love the people. People at Yahoo are great. Like, they just want to do good work. They want to be good humans. They want to drive great results. And it's a fun place to work.
Well, you're touching a little bit on a couple more questions, but you're touching a little bit just on culture.
Huge advocate for positive culture.
What do you do? Like, how do you do that? What do you follow? A school of thought, a methodology, a framework? Is there some pattern that you've put into your teams? I don't know. Talk to me. Like, how do you drive that culture?
I think it's built on trust, and it's built on staying human and personally accountable. And I think displaying the attributes that you expect to see and showing up in every meeting, again, you know, kind of coming back to that, like, direct communication. We have all these sort of informal taglines, one of which is make money, have fun. Like, it is very possible to run a really successful sales organization and for everyone to have financial success at a personal level and also have a ton of fun. And I think our culture is, we don't take anything too seriously. We make jokes out of everything. A PR partner said to me, "Yo, I mean, this is PR, not ER, and let's not mistake that." So there's, like, all these things together. I think at the same time, that works, that, like, culture of fun works, because at the core, we've got a bunch of autonomous 11s who are really serious about doing great work. So the culture of fun only works if you know you have these driven humans who want to do spectacular work on behalf of clients.
I just got goosebumps. I got goosebumps. Like, it's true though, right? Because if the, like, bar you're setting and hiring and who you're bringing on creates that culture. Generally, I close out these with asking, like, what's the best piece of advice you've received along your journey? And you shared that. Well, you shared a great piece of advice earlier around, like, don't forget everyone on this floor and everyone's working for you. So I probably want to close it out with asking you, you know, fast forward 10 years from now, what do you think are going to be the most disruptive innovations for our revenue teams?
I am so excited to shed these repeatable processes. In 1997, if you had said in 2007, I'm going to be able to tell you how to get to your mom's house via a small computer held in your hand, I wouldn't have believed you. I mean, I would have said that sounds so futuristic. I think the things that we are doing today are so futuristic compared to 10 and even 5 years ago. And again, this whole concept of like rapidly expanding compute power with edge computing, it's happening at a massive rate of change. And so I can't even imagine what annoying sales processes we won't have to deal with in the future and the efficiency that will take place as a result of that. And, you know, we're kind of seeing some of that today. It's just today it's like a little bit clunky. We're recording calls for coaching. We're, you know, notes that come out of the calls, like automated summaries, like those things are amazing. And yet we're in the very infancy of that actually being usable. So really excited to see what's going to be happening around here in 10 years. I can't even imagine it.
I have like sore cheeks from smiling during this conversation. It has been really fun and I appreciate your time. I just want to say thank you for joining us for this episode. For all of our listeners, please a reminder to follow Gong on LinkedIn for our tactical takeaways from this conversation. And then we're also going to include best plays to add to your playbook, of course. And be sure to follow the show so you never miss an episode. But Alia, thank you. Thank you for your time and your insight and just telling your story. What an awesome ride you've had, and just grateful for this time with you. So thank you.
Same for me, Dana. I would like to crown you an honorary autonomous 11, I can tell.
Thanks so much for joining us for this episode. Follow Gong on LinkedIn for our tactical takeaways from this conversation, including the best plays to add to your playbook. And be sure to follow the show to never miss an episode.